Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schnack. This is episode number 394. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com, stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is thisshowissogay. And of course, go on over to that Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. We have just the most incredible show for you this week with two of my favorite people on this planet. Let's get to the first one. Emily Saliers is one half of the duo The Indigo Girls. Together with Amy, she has sold over 15 million albums worldwide, including 8 double platinum, platinum and gold discs, as well as earning 6 Grammy nominations. In 1989, they were nominated for Best New Artist and took home the Grammy for Best Contemporary Folk Album. Emily has written so many of those classics, including Closer to Fine, Get Out the Map, Galileo, Least Complicated. I can't list them all because we won't have time to chat. The Indigo Girls are well known for their social and environmental activism. They worked for nearly 2 decades with Honor the Earth, the nonprofit foundation they co-founded, on issues of environmental justice, and they have supported innumerable grassroots organizations. Emily is also the co-owner, because apparently she has free time, of the acclaimed Watershed restaurant on Peachtree, and she co-authored the book that is in my hands right now, A Song to Sing, A Life to Live, Reflections on Music as Spiritual Practice, with her dad, Don Saliers. Emily is recording her first solo album. It's going to be released in 2017. We're going to talk all about it. And on April 1st, she will be performing at the Akron Civic Center. My tickets are right in front of me. But before we get to all of that, Emily, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Ken, I don't know what to say after all that, except that I, too, am so gay.
I love it. I love it. Now, let's just get this out of the way right at the start. What level of gushing slash crying can I do that won't make you uncomfortable?
There's very little that makes me uncomfortable.
Okay.
So just be yourself.
Okay. All right. Because I think, and by the way, it was 7 years ago this month that we had Amy on the show, and I think she's still uncomfortable from the gushing that I did.
I'm kind of a gushy person myself, so we'll be okay.
Okay. We're going to do fine. We have so much ground to cover. Emily, are you ready?
I'm ready, Ken.
All right, let's do it. So you've been in the Indigo Girls. You've been performing with Amy since you were, 15 years old. So it's been a good, 7 or 8 years now, right?
Right.
Yes.
Right.
What was the goal in those early days? When you two first started playing together, where did you see yourself?
I can honestly say we had so much fun. We just started because she was the other girl who played guitar and wrote songs. And you know how you kind of have your radar out for other people in your school. We met in elementary school. Went to the same high school. In high school, we joined the chorus. She played guitar. I played guitar. She wrote songs. I wrote songs. We just started to get together after school, like with two kids with something in common. And then we started playing gigs like almost immediately. We were very encouraged by our AP English professor, teacher, I guess they called him in high school.
Yeah.
And he felt like a professor, like godly in his influence over us. And we just loved it so much that we never thought about, oh, we're going to do this forever and we're going to do this goal and achieve this. We just wanted to play the next great gig. And then that included a feeling of like once we get to college, we put a single out in 85 and then an EP out in 86 and then Strange Fire out in 87. And so that was the same feeling. Let's do the next thing that is cool and we haven't done yet. And we kind of have the same philosophy today, and it's just crazy to think about how far we've come and how long we've been together. And I love Amy, and I love playing with her, and it's just been incredible. But we never had any like super massive awesome goals, and we never intended to get signed to a major label.
Wow. Wow. I have a recording. I think many of us have this recording of you opening for the Grateful Dead. And I just remember in this recording, and I hear it all the time as I play it, you both seem genuinely surprised that people know the lyrics to your songs.
We're actually, we've been touring in the Northwest and Oregon, and I always think about that show. I mean, the whole thing is still surprising to me, honestly, even though we've been connected to it from point to point and place to place and experience to experience over the years. I still am sometimes up on the stage with Amy and I'm like, I cannot believe this.
Wow.
And It's mostly because of the people, you know, and when you get that kind of, like, everybody's in it together, and especially right now with our political situation in this country, we need music and we need art of all forms to educate us and to inspire us and to bring us together and also to let us grieve what we're grieving. And so, when I think about people learning of the lyrics and singing the songs, it's still, even though maybe I can understand in my head how that all has happened, I still feel it's a bit of a mystery, and I still feel more than ever now gratitude for it all.
It comes across. It truly comes across. Now, some people will hear an Indigo Girls song and think, oh, okay, well, that must be an Emily song, and that one, that's clearly an Amy song. Do you feel that's legit?
To a great extent. Well, largely because the songs that she writes, she sings, and the songs that I write, I sing.
There it is.
And so tonally, there's a bit of a difference, you know, but Amy, she can write as tender and affecting a ballad. I'm sort of known for my ballads as I do. And, you know, she's just a great rock and roll songwriter. I have all that in my spirit, but I'm not able to write it in the way that she does. And so I think, and she has a more of an immediacy about her angst and edginess. And I just have a different way, you know, just walk a little bit of a different way in the world and in my music. So I think it's fair to say. I think that with my solo record, and I know we're going to talk about that,
oh, yeah,
but it has allowed me to reach into some of the depths of my influences and inspirations that Indigo Girls don't typically do. So, but I think in our catalog, you can generally say, yeah, that's more of an Amy type song, and that's more of an Emily type song.
And you are keenly aware, correct, that there are those of us who go around saying, ugh, I'm having more of an Emily day today, and others who will say, I'm having more of an Amy day.
It's the older I get, the more zen I get about not, comparing things. And I always have this insecurity of like, oh, yeah, well, you know, Amy's the edgier one. She's more rock and roll. And I want to be that. I don't want to be the Emily Day. I want to be the Amy Day. But, you know, I know as in a duo, you're just set up for comparisons, and especially since Amy and I are sort of like diametrically opposed in many ways on the surface, but at our core, our values and our hearts are in the same place. And so I think people do gravitate towards different sounds and songs, and that's natural, and that's awesome.
I will never for the rest of my life get out of my head the idea that Emily Saliers wakes up one day and says, oh, I want to have an Amy Ray day.
Well, I think it's just only natural to always compare yourself in some way to the person you've been working with for over 35 years, you know. But there's so much that I admire about Amy. You know, I admire her quick decision making, and she's a very clear thinker. I'm a little bit like my head in the clouds type person. So there are those things. I think we always see things in other people. Obviously, this is coming down to cheap psychology, of course, but that we always admire in other people and wish we had in ourselves. But yeah, but you know, quite honestly, I am who I am, and I'm quite happy with who I am. And we all struggle with comparing ourselves to other people or things. And so it's all good.
It's all good. It's all good. Let's talk about concerts. I've always imagined, and you tell me if I'm wrong, that part of the challenge for you two in playing a concert is finding that balance between playing new material versus playing your catalog. Is that indeed a challenge for you?
It is a challenge in that, I mean, on a very basic level, I want people to enjoy the show, you know? That's the reason we're there, is like to play these songs. And we always make a new set list every night. We never play the same set list because Amy and I, it is just not worth it to us if we're not full heart and soul into the things that we play. And so we even leave open, you know, we're open to suggestions. The other night someone called out Watershed and we didn't have it on the list and there was a spot and I just shifted that song out and Watershed in. But if someone had hollered out a song that I didn't feel like playing, a song of mine or a song of Amy's, if she doesn't feel like playing, then we just don't do it because it feels inauthentic,
right?
You know, you have to really connect to the songs, at least we do. And so I think that we just keep it fresh over the years by writing new set lists. And part of the writing of the set list is if you have a new record out, we don't want to just do old songs,
right?
For a couple of reasons. One is that we're super excited about the new stuff. We wouldn't have written it and recorded it if we weren't. And second of all, you have you have to give credence to people out there who really want to hear new music.
Yeah.
In addition to the very vocal people who mostly want to hear old music, you know, the ones who tend to be the most vocal in the audiences. And then you just want to keep growing. And the only way that new songs become old favorites is by playing them live. So we're very conscientious about that when we make the set list. And when we make a new record, typically the set list will weigh more heavily than normal on new material. But it's never to a tipping point where it's going to be like, this is going to alienate people who want to hear Closer to Fine.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to tread very carefully with this next question, because I've been nervous about asking you this for a while. Have there been times where you have perhaps wished that people didn't sing quite so loud?
Never.
Okay.
Never, ever, ever. I'm surprised you're nervous to ask that.
I am nervous because I'm one of those people and I don't want to get shut down.
You know what it is? It's like when people sing, the energy of that, like, it's a mystical thing. People singing, especially in public, even if you can't sing in tune, singing is such a visceral thing, you know?
Yeah.
And to not feel self-conscious about it and to do it in a crowd of people, it's extremely powerful. I mean, it is a joyful thing and it's cathartic, and it's the reason why all the great social movements, the history of social movements of humanity, have had songs that anchor people to those movements, because the act of singing together is powerful, you know? And so I never, ever wish that people didn't. I love it when people
okay,
sing.
Okay, good. Just checking, because April 1st is coming up quick, and I'll be right there in Akron. So if I need to temper things, I need to know. I need to know these things. You are appearing right this second on This Show Is So Gay, and you started off the interview by asserting that you are indeed so gay as well. Talk to me about being an out musician. Do we feel that's still a thing that people are struggling with, or it's just not something necessarily on your radar because you've been doing it for so long?
I think it's kind of under the umbrella of people like to put things in boxes.
Yeah.
And a need for identifying things. And I think that that's really still going on. And I don't know, it may go on for a long, long time as human beings just fumble through our human beingness, you know, because especially now in terms of trying to think in a non-binary way in terms of gender identity and fluidity in terms of sexuality, and sort of just breaking down some of those puritanical fears and the things that so much of this country were founded on. And
right.
Just like, you know, we have so far to go in the expansion of our acceptance, understanding, and joy in the fact of our fluidity and diversity. And so that's ongoing. As far as being like, it's so weird. The more we can accept ourselves and be different things and not necessarily this or that, sort of less I feel like calling myself a lesbian, if
yeah.
you know what I mean. Like,
yeah.
a girlfriend and I were joking the other night about, oh, the lesbians were just like, we're like old school identifying as lesbians. And it's just, it's very refreshing as people become less judgmental and more accepting. And so that is ongoing. And now, terrible, terrible discrimination
yeah.
against our trans members of our communities, and the terribly high suicide rates among sexual minority youth, the continuation of people being ousted and ostracized by their families and their churches and whatever group. You know, I remember growing up and being gay in a loving family, and back then we didn't even have really words for it. You know, I just knew I was different, and when I came out, I had a good experience with my family, but it didn't stop me from developing self-homophobia
right.
over trying to constantly validate myself in the wake of all this cultural, these angry voices that said, you're nothing, you know, you're not as valid. If you have a kid, it won't be the same as two straight people having a kid. And if you're not worth it, you're nothing. And so that wore me down. Now I've come around to a really good place about it. But to answer your question, being an out musician is not controversial in the way that it once was,
mm-hmm.
but issues of acceptance and openness about how we try to put ourselves in boxes is the same as it ever was. So, or you know, it's gotten better. I shouldn't say it's the same as it ever was, but so many members of our queer community are threatened, beaten, killed, ostracized, made to be depressed, suicidal. These are real, real, real life problems that still exist.
Yeah. So much work to do. There's a lot of work to do.
Yep.
Emily, for our listeners who don't know about him, tell everybody about your dad.
Oh, my dad. I love him. His name is Don Saliers. He's a theologian. He was a professor of theology in the Candler School of Theology at Emory University for almost 40 years.
Wow.
37 years. Prior to that, he was at Yale University in New Haven, which is where I was born, but we moved down to Atlanta when I was 9. And so he is a church musician. I think he would have been a professional touring musician if he hadn't gotten called. And he's a progressive theologian. So he and my mom grew up going to church, but we never had anything demanded of us in terms of what we believed or the questions we asked.
Yeah.
And he's a remarkable man. He's 79 years old, and he's still willing to learn and be open. And he really loves me and Amy, and he loves Indigo Girls, but he's well respected in his own circles. And so we wrote a book together to just explore music as a spiritual practice. And he, of course, comes from a sacred music perspective, and I came from, like, you know, we're a bar band.
Right.
But music speaks the same to the experience of searching for a deeper connection in life. He's awesome.
We like him.
He likes the gays. He's so gay an ally.
I love it. We're going to get him on the show. A Song to Sing, A Life to Live, Reflections on Music as Spiritual Practice. Again, listeners, we are here with Emily Saliers, one half of the duo The Indigo Girls, who is setting out on her own for a solo album coming up. What prompted this, Emily?
It started about decades ago.
Okay.
I suppose. I'm a little bit of a late bloomer, but ultimately, I'm a big lover of rap music, R&B music. First record I ever bought was Jackson 5. Stevie Wonder, hugely influential. I was totally into the funk movement. But here I am kind of stuck in the body of a acoustic guitar singer-songwriter. And so this record was a bit of an attempt to, because I love beats. I love contemporary urban music. And I love African-American gospel music. But I'm not that. So, but this record was a very joyful journey to connect to some of that, like a very strong rhythmic center.
Yeah.
In a way that Amy and I don't do typically with Indigo Girls, even though Indigo Girls is at the center of my musical life, and as far as I can tell, always will be. But this was a great, like, side journey. And then I found my producer friend, Lyris Hung, who plays violin with us. She was like Juilliard and Columbia, classical music, Suzuki trained, but she had a metal band and she loves all kinds of different music. And I started sending her these little snippets of songs, and she did these arrangements at home in her studio and sent them back. And I'm like, oh my God, I want to make a solo record now. Cause I didn't know how to articulate it musically before. And she did. And so I started writing these songs, and some of them are old, like one I wrote with Kristen Hall, who's an original member of the band Sugarland.
Yeah.
We wrote that song about 15 years ago. And then one song called Fly was written after the election when I was just devastated and needed to bolster myself. And so the solo record is an amalgamation of old songs and a deep desire to hook into my R&B spirit. And finding Lyris Hung, and then very, very a lot of contemporary political, social, geopolitical issues are included in the content of the record.
It's so great. And folks can stroll on over to pledgemusic.com and they can support this. I have to tell you, it took about, I would say conservatively, 50 to 55 seconds before I picked up handwritten lyrics to Closer to Fine, which are sitting right in front of me, and I cannot find the perfect frame for them. So if you have an idea for that, Emily, I'll take the idea.
I'm not really artistic when it comes to thinking about framing.
Okay.
But now that you've brought it up and I like you and you are so gay, I will think about it.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I appreciate that. Sure. Tell everybody about the restaurant, by the way. That sounds like, I just was looking at the menu. That's a place I want to go to.
Oh, it's so good. Every time I'm home, I eat there. It's so good. And in fact, a few of the Pledge Music pledgers, we met together at the restaurant. It's called Watershed on Peachtree. We had brunches together. It was really fun.
That sounds
But we
fun.
Used to be in Decatur. We used to be in a converted garage. We've been open for almost 20 years. And we were kind of the first farm-to-table restaurant in Decatur. And then we moved to a different location that had like a big, like had an outdoor patio, and you could have private dining there. And it just had more sort of space for different dining purposes. And it's a beautiful restaurant. We have this new chef. Well, he's not that new anymore, but he feels new. He's so vibrant. Zeb Stevenson. And it's kind of a twist on Southern food, but it's mainly, you know, organic whenever possible, locally produced, raised, sourced, humanely sourced, raised. And I'm very proud of it. It's a great restaurant.
Great stuff. Great stuff. Do they play your music at the restaurant?
It may come on the Spotify channel or something.
Okay.
It's never been, mostly my stuff when I'm out in public hearing it, it's like at the grocery store. So I'll be shopping and I'll hear Power of Two.
That's like, amazing.
I've got to go to the restroom right now and hide.
There has to have been. What is the weirdest place? I remember asking Billy Myers this about Kiss the Rain, and she had some great stories about the unbelievable places she heard her own song. What's one of those where you heard one of your own songs and you're thinking, how did that just happen?
In an elevator.
Yeah, it had to be.
Because then you really are elevator music.
Yeah.
I mean, it can't, the metaphor meets reality in the elevator.
It's a resume builder, Emily. I think it's a resume builder.
I mean, at this point, I swear, everything is all good. And, you know, it's kind of like a feather in the cap when you get, you know, played in an elevator and you are elevator music.
I love it. When all of our listeners download this, purchase your solo CD, and they finish listening to the whole thing, do some authorial intent for us. You can dictate to all of us, how would you like us to feel when we're done listening?
First of all, I would ask that you listen to it two or three times through.
Great.
Because I think while musically it's very, it is immediate enough to capture, I think, your attention, it's pretty dense in terms of its subject matter. Although there are a couple songs in there that are just super lighthearted. I did a duo with Jennifer Nettles, who's not only a great singer, but one of my favorite people. So there is that to balance it. But I would hope that people go on a journey with it, and that they can find things in their own lives that they can relate to the music, which is always the purpose. I mean, that's been the whole thing for me and Amy. Like, we write about our own lives or what we observe, and fortunately, there are plenty of people out there who have the same kind of experiences or observations, or the music is cathartic in some way. And so I really hope that people will be able to connect with their own lives. But we really, really thought carefully on how to put the songs together and take y'all on the same trip that I went on in writing the songs and making the record.
Can't wait. All right. While we have you on the show, we can't have you on without playing a little bit of a game with you. Give you a chance.
Okay.
Give you a chance to win some This Show Is So Gay magnets that I'll drop off for you on April 1st at the Akron Civic Center. Not bad.
I'll hold them up from the stage.
That would be a lot. That I'm overwhelmed by even the idea of that. But here's the problem. I will tell you, Emily, when you have spare time, which I think is never, one of the things that I need you to work on, Indigo Girls trivia online, it stinks. There's barely any out there. So we need to start developing some better quizzes online about the Indigo Girls, because it's truly things like fill in the blank, closer to, okay, come on, that's not going to stump Emily. So I have four questions. You're going to get all four. I'm not worried about it, but I just would like to put out there, any of our listeners, you need to start working on some Indigo Girls trivia, because the quiz is out there, not so good. So you ready? You ready to play? You're going to get two out of four. These are not hard.
I'm ready.
There is, by the way, truly, one of the quizzes is called The Indigo Girls and Issues of Mortality. I just want to put that out there. But we're not reading from that one.
Yeah, we're known for our lighthearted content or song, so that's cool. Yep.
Question number one. Which of the following songs does not have a theme? I swear, this is from Indigo Girls Trivia Online. Which of the following songs does not have a theme that involves the death of a cat, either implied or mentioned? So only one of these songs does not involve the death of a cat. You ready? Your four choices are Dead Man's Hill, Ozolin, secure yourself, or pushing the needle too far?
Oslin.
That is the correct answer. Very good. Okay. Question number two. In the liner notes, for 1200 Curfews, about which song did Amy just write Fish Out of Water?
Oh, God, it's one of mine. What would that have been?
It actually, I'm going to give you a hint. It actually is not one of yours. It was a cover.
Is it Midnight Train to Georgia?
The correct answer is Midnight Train to Georgia. Very good, Emily. Very good.
And I knew it either had to be one of mine or one of mine. That, yeah, cool. That's funny.
Question number three. Amy Ray said of this song, quote, "The wisdom of the song that I have tried to learn is about the simple cycles of life and how to learn from them and how to appreciate beauty in the face of physical pain." Okay? Your four choices are Cordova, Blood and Fire, Kid Fears, or Oslin.
I'm going to say Kid Fears.
The correct answer is sadly again, Oslin. I just wanted every answer to be Oslin. Now, you already won. So you already got two out of three, but let's just go for the fourth one, which I just think is the best question on here. Question number four. In 1995, at the Pascack Hills High School talent show, which Rites of Passage song did I sing with Mandy Filer, accompanied on the piano by Karen Seegerman?
Okay, let me think about Rites of Passage.
I will bring you, I swear, like 30 magnets
Galileo.
If you get this one right. No,
Galileo.
Come on. I'm not that much of a cliche. I'll give you two more guesses.
Chicken Man.
One more to go.
Hey, Vasemir. three hits.
The correct answer was Love Will Come to You.
Oh.
It's okay. You're still a winner. You're still a winner.
How could I have known?
Well, because I thought maybe word of that performance got back to you. I guess not so much.
Well, I have problems with my memory, so don't take it personally.
I won't. All right, Emily, for all of our aspiring singer-songwriters out there, let's conclude with some learning annex with Emily Saliers. For those of us who are struggling to get those words from our head to the page, what's Emily's patented advice to make this work?
Oh, you've got to be connected to the feeling,
yeah.
First of all. So it's got to be, it can't be from your head as much as it has to be from your heart and your soul and your insides. And then try to pick images that are evocative, you know, and not just words, not just general descriptions of things like, I felt so scared, but, you know, like the needle approached the soft blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
It's a search for specific images that are evocative. Matched with real, real feelings that you can hook into. And that's always where I try to start. And then it really, like, try to have it be your own voice. And for the longest time, all I could do was emulate other songwriters. I wanted to be Joni Mitchell. I wanted to be Stevie Wonder. I wanted to be other people besides me. And then I started to find my own voice. So those are the things. Make sure you're connected to it emotionally. Look for other images besides words, general words, and find your own voice.
There it is. There it is. Listeners, this is what we need you to do right this very second. You can stroll on over to emilysaliers.com. We will certainly link to it. Learn more about what's coming up for her. Shows are coming up again April 1st in Akron at the Akron Civic Center. I have yet to be there, so I am excited to go there for the first time, and Emily will be my first concert there. You can go to pledgemusic.com and type in Emily Saliers, and there's still things that you can pick up there. And you can, of course, go to indigogirls.com and learn more about the Indigo Girls. Emily, I have to be very upfront with you. I am barely holding it together speaking to you, and I've been doing this for a really long time. I truly cannot overstate to you the place of your words in my life. They have gotten me through so many hard times, and I think it's easy to say, right, it's gotten me through hard times. They've also made some of my great times so much better, and That whole lyric of the best thing you ever did for me was to help me take my life less seriously is the motto that I live by. It guides so much of how I approach this world. And truly, there is no adequate way I can express my appreciation for how much you have enhanced my life on this planet. I am so appreciative.
Thanks, Ken. I mean, thank you so much for that. Honestly, I really feel that this is, I mean, for lack of a better way to describe it, all a team effort, that it's reciprocal, that it's just, that we all are a part of it and nobody owns it. And so I really feel that way. And I'm very grateful for your words. And I'm just so glad that Amy and I, and now me a little bit on my own, like this Akron show is kind of a big deal for me, because it's really like one of the first real shows I play on my own. And my friend Lucy Wainwright Roach is going to be there with me, and Lyris Hung, who produced the record, is going to be there. So we're like in good company. But it, like, to your words, like, we're all, music affects us the same way.
Yeah.
And I swear, I am so lucky to be one of the ones who gets to write it and play it and experience that reciprocity. So thank you, Ken.
We are right there with you again, listeners. April 1st, the Akron Civic Theater. Go pick up tickets. Emily, please keep doing what you're doing.
Ken, I want my magnet. You come and I give you a big hug, give you a big southern hug.
Guess I wasn't the best one to ask me myself, with my face pressed up against love's glass, to see the shiny toy I've been hoping for, the one I never can.
All right, folks, and we are back with our second incredible guest of this week's show. Let me introduce him to you. Telly Leung is an actor, a singer, a performer, a producer, and so much more. He has performed live all over the world, from Carnegie Hall to the Kennedy Center to the Hollywood Bowl to London's Hippodrome. His stage credits are way too numerous to list, but they include his Broadway debut in the 2002 revival of Flower Drum Song, his work in the Roundabout Theater Company's revival of Pacific Overtures, his memorable time in the final Broadway cast of Rent, that time he originated the role of Bach in the Chicago company of Wicked, a much acclaimed appearance in the revival of Godspell, and his star turn in Allegiance. On the small screen, audiences everywhere recognize Telly from his role as Wes on Glee and for his coaching on the PBS documentary Broadway or Bust. In addition to the many cast albums on which he appears, Telly can also be heard on his solo albums, 2012's I'll Cover You and 2015's Songs for You. These days, you can catch him at the Circle in the Square Theater, starring in the new Broadway show In Transit. But right this second, he's here with us. Telly, welcome to the show. It's So Gay.
Oh, thank you so much, Ken. It's so good to be with you. That was a long intro.
And I left stuff out.
I was like, oh my God. I sometimes you don't realize kind of how much you've done until you hear it all said out loud.
I love it. And by the way, just for some transition material here, it strikes me, we just finished talking to Emily from the Indigo Girls, it strikes me that you have some Indigo Girls appreciation.
Okay, I'm starstruck via phone that you just had Emily from the Indigo Girls on, because so I grew up in the 90s when Lilith Fair was a huge thing.
Yes.
I mean, this was before I knew I was gay or came out or anything. Like, you know, I was in high school, and I had a very dear friend who had an aunt who worked press and publicity and always got free tickets to the Lilith Fair.
Oh,
so
my.
We went, and, you know, I got to catch some amazing performers during that festival. You know, I think I went 3 years straight. Natalie Merchant, you know, Sarah McLachlan, of course, Missy Elliott performed. But always, the showstopper was always the Indigo Girls. And I remember, you know, and of course, Lilith Fair and the Indigo Girls have a very popular lesbian following.
Yeah.
So you have to imagine me, you know, 15-year-old Telly Leung, you know, high school student, little Asian kid, standing in the middle of a sea of lesbians, like, grooving out to Galileo. Like, I mean, by the third year that I went to Lilith Fair, like, I just felt like I was, like, I must have been a lesbian in
past
life or something, because, like, I totally jive with this music. It just goes to show, you know, music is unifying and universal and has no color or race or sexual orientation. And, you know, it's kind of an amazing thing. You know, it's but the Indigo Girls are a big part of kind of my high school soundtrack for me.
You singing Galileo, people can watch it on YouTube. It's brilliant, Telly.
Oh, well, thank you. So when I do club acts all over the country and all over the world, I have this phenomenal band that goes with me. You know, when we get together to rehearse, you know, we pitch ideas, musical ideas to each other. And, you know, I come from the world of Broadway.
Right.
And I've done plenty of Stephen Schwartz shows. So I said, you know, what if, I said, I love the song Galileo, but I said, what if our idea for it is, what if Stephen Schwartz had written this song and not Amy and Emily? Jimmy, like, what if this was approached from a different musical ear and it was like a Stephen Schwartz story song, you know, like Meadowlark from The Baker's Wife.
Right.
You know, so that's kind of how we approached that arrangement of it. But we definitely keep little homages to the Indigo Girls for sure. But I think it's a fun way to kind of pay homage to a song and an artist you really love, but also make listeners hear it in a new and different way through a different lens.
I want to remind our listeners that I, Ken Schneck, and Telly Leung will be appearing at 54 Below in May. We'll be doing Songs from Lilith. I'm just announcing that now.
Oh, yeah. No, right? That'd be amazing.
Well, let's get to you. Let's get to you. I feel like I know you because we grew up a few miles apart. We're of the same age, you know, high school in very similar places. It strikes me, though, from doing some research on you, that the performing life, we talk a lot about families on this show for the past 9-10 years, and the performing life was maybe not exactly what your family wanted for you.
Yeah, you know, I grew up in an immigrant home, very traditional Chinese parents from China who came here and crashed on friends' couches in the 70s, you know, in Chinatown, and only had $200 in their pocket and the suitcases that they had. And so, you know, they worked very hard and they scraped every penny for their one and only child, me, and they could only afford to have one child. So, I mean, I come from, you know, I come from very like middle class upbringing in Brooklyn, working class parents.
Right.
And, you know, their aspirations for me, like many tiger moms and immigrant Chinese parents, are, you know, oh, my son one day will become doctor, you know, go to Harvard and be doctor or lawyer, you know, and have all the things that they couldn't afford to have when they came to the United States. So definitely when I had to tell them that I wanted to be not a doctor, but an artist instead, you know, it was a difficult conversation.
Yeah.
I've always said it was much harder coming out as an actor to them than actually coming out.
Wow.
Like, that was actually more difficult to say to my parents, hey, guys, I'm not going to, you know, all that saving and hard work. I know you wanted it to be funneled in this way, but it's my life and I can't do that. That's not what I want to do. You know, I can't stand the sight of blood. Like, I can't see myself sitting in an office and pushing paper the rest of my life. And I said, I think I'm supposed to do something else. And of course, my parents, it took them a while to understand what that was. And I think some of that is, you know, immigrants come here and their American dream was just a monetary dream.
Right.
You know, this was a country for them where if they worked hard and they were smart with their money, they could have all those things that they could not have in the mother country, in China. And for me, I feel like, you know, yes, I'm now the American dream is passed on to me, but it's a different dream for me. You know, America means you can, yes, if you work hard, you can get to where you want to be, but you also have the choice of what it is that you want to do with your life. And I think in many ways, you know, as I get older with my parents and as they become more and more supportive of not just my lifestyle as an artist, but also my lifestyle as a gay person, I think that finally they understand, oh, right, this is the other part of the American dream that they did not have the luxury to experience because they only could concentrate on how do we pay the mortgage this month? How do
right.
we make sure Telly goes to college? You know, how do we put 3 meals on the table? And now I feel like they're saying, oh, Telly does all of that and he gets to do what he wants to do and is passionate about, which is being an artist, and he gets to live freely with his partner
yeah.
and be who he is, you know, and get married in this country. And so I think they're kind of understanding the other side of the American dream through me.
Yeah. And like so many of us gay kids in New York City in the mid to late 90s, Rent played a huge role in your life.
Huge. I mean, Rent came out when I was 16 years old.
Yeah.
And I remember you know, Rent also created the $20 lottery ticket,
I remember.
Where if you slept with the bums on 41st Street outside the Niederlander Theater, back when Times Square was much seedier than it is now, before Disney came, it's, you know, you could sit in the front first two rows of Rent and watch that show. And I remember, it's the first time I've ever cried at the theater.
Yeah.
And it dealt with such mature themes and mature subject matters, and I didn't understand all of it at 16 years old. There's
right.
no way, you know, but there was something so raw and so real, and the stakes of the story and what people were going through living with HIV and AIDS that really hit home for me. And it was kind of the first time I saw theater that, you know, the life on whatever the life on stage was actually a reflection of what was happening in the world outside the theater as well. And
right.
I think that really moved me. That really taught me a lesson that theater, yes, can be very entertaining. You know, theater can be Cats and theater can be, you know, Les Mis and all of those things, but theater can also be very socially relevant.
Yeah. You could not walk by an NYU dorm room at that time and not hear it blasting. And I remember all of us saying, this is such our lives. This is such our lives, which no, we're going to NYU. We're not exactly living the most bohemian
right.
life out there. But was Angel always the role that you connected with?
It's interesting. It actually wasn't the role I always connected with. Oddly enough, like, you know, Angel was a role that I ended up doing quite often, but
right.
The role that I ended up connecting with, that I ended up actually doing the most on Broadway, was an ensemble track. It was Steve and others
yeah.
who gets to sing Will I? And he asks that pivotal question in the show, will I lose my dignity?
Right.
Will someone care? Will I wake tomorrow from this nightmare? And I feel like that moment was actually the moment I remember being like, I don't know, I don't understand. Why am I crying?
Right.
You know, it's that lyric sung in a round. And that I felt really, really moved me, and was the universal thing that made me, you know, I had never met a drag queen before, you know, or anybody in drag at 16 years old, but you know, I'd never met, you know, a drug addicted go-go dancer, you know, wearing tight blue pants. I'd never met a rock singer who had HIV and AIDS. I'd never met a documentary filmmaker, but everybody asking that question on a stage made it so that I was like, oh, right, I am those people too. Like, I can relate. That was my into that world. And that we all ask that question. We all ask it. You know, will I lose my dignity? Will someone care? Will I wake tomorrow from this nightmare? I mean, I feel like I watch the news every day and I ask that question
right.
now as we deal with Trump as president. I'm like, will I wake from this nightmare of what's happening?
Now, every time I watch the news, I'm going to expect that it fades out into those bars of will I. You just
right?
messed that up for me. Thank you very much. That's awesome. Now, on last year's show, on an episode last year, we had the great opportunity to speak with Mark Acedo and his work on Allegiance. Talk to our listeners about Allegiance, because I'm so regret that I was not able to see it, and everyone in my life who saw it just raved about it, and what a great opportunity for you.
Well, what's wonderful is that for folks that did not get to catch our run live on Broadway, is that our producers brilliantly did a phenomenal shoot of our final performances on Broadway. And Fathom Events has actually started to do national cinecasts in like 400 to 600 screens
wow.
all over the country, all over Canada. And they're doing kind of these one-day events where people all over the country now can see Allegiance. It did. We did one in December of last year. It did very well. We had an encore presentation in February, which also did very well. And we're just waiting for Fathom to say, hey, let's do it again, because they keep selling out all over the country. So even though many people missed our four-month run on Broadway, I think what's so wonderful about Allegiance is that it's having this other life outside of a Broadway run because of Fathom Events and what they've done. They're bringing Broadway to your hometown, which is awesome. There's so many people that can't afford to come to
right.
New York City or afford the price of a Broadway ticket. And now we're bringing Broadway to them, you know, and it's especially wonderful because of the content of this story. You know, it's always been the story is something that is inspired by the real life of our star, George Takei, who,
yeah.
you know, many people know as Sulu from Star Trek, and many people know him from his LGBT activism. What many people did not know was that at 5 years old, you know, he and his family were part of the 120,000 Japanese Americans that were forced to leave their homes in California after the bombing of Pearl Harbor because they were suspected as being, you know, a threat to national security, and they were forced to live in these internment camps in the Midwest. And it's a story I feel like that is very resonant now in our political climate, and it's an important story to tell, and a story that is often not told. And I feel like with Allegiance, we've done it in a way. It's very much the same idea of Rent, you know, or shows like Fiddler on the Roof, where, you know, I don't understand what it is to be an Eastern European Jew, right? But I do understand what it is to be in a family, and to have a family go through something that is, you know, difficult in society, and how a family gets through that, and seeing the lens of that political event, you know, happen through the lens of a family. And I think it's the same thing with Allegiance, you know, seeing a kind of something happen in the world that is large and huge and historic, but seeing it through the lens of the Kimura family, and how you're and putting yourself in the shoes of what would I do? What would my sister do? What would my father have done in that situation? And it was a joy to work on that show, because it meant so much to George, and it meant so much to me to be able to tell that story. And I worked on it for, you know, 7 years. You know, it took us 7 years from page to stage to develop the show, from a reading, you know, where we read the libretto, and we sang the songs, you know, at music stands, all the way up to taking the show out of town in San Diego to bringing it to Broadway. It took 7 years for us to get that show to Broadway.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable stuff. Yeah. Again, listeners, we're here with Telly Leung, actor, singer, performer, producer. You know, I have to say, as a college professor who teaches mostly about race and sexual orientation and diversity in society, Glee has single-handedly made my work easier. And yeah. You get to say, hey, I was totally on that show. How do you wrap your mind around being on iconic Glee?
Well, the crazy thing is, you know, when I, as an actor, you know, you often get hired for gigs and you go, wow, that's a really great gig. I'm going to go out and be on this hit TV show. And originally they said, you know, you're going to be a warbler. You're going to be on for 2 episodes as we introduce this new character, Darren Criss's character, Blaine, and then you'll probably be done. And I said, oh, how great. I'll spend a couple of weeks in LA. That's awesome.
Great.
What ended up happening was, you know, and as often happens with Glee, is that it kind of transcended just being television, entertaining television. I think in our society, where we were dealing with bullying, especially bullying in the, you know, for LGBT teens, for kids that were just starting to come out and discover their sexual identity, but being bullied for that, you know, I felt like TV audience members were hungry for some way to deal with that, to talk about that difficult subject matter. And here was Glee, a hit TV show that was a water cooler show. Everybody was talking about what happened last night on Glee, you know, and it was beamed into everybody's televisions on a Tuesday night in prime time. And they unapologetically showed this beautiful teenage gay relationship between these two boys, and the whole country fell in love with them.
Yeah.
And the whole country related to them and saw them as human, as just two loving human beings. You know, what I love about Glee is that they knew that they had such a powerful platform, and they oftentimes used it for good. They used it to cause positive conversation and positive social change. And when I was actually doing it, I didn't realize that. Do you know what I mean? I really didn't. I was like, oh, what a wonderful job. It's going to be great. And how cool. And I realized that on the second episode we shot, where, you know, I remember Darren having a moment going, guys, Katy Perry just tweeted at me about Teenage Dream. And I was like, what? Katy Perry tweeted you? That's crazy. Like, yeah, Katy Perry loves our version of Teenage Dream. And I said, that's so wild. I mean, little did we know that, like, then the Warblers became some, and Darren, of course, that storyline, they just kept writing for us because the fans were hungry for it.
Absolutely. Oh, man. Incredible stuff. Incredible stuff. Well, you've been hanging out these days over at the Circle in the Square Theater. Talk to our listeners about In Transit.
Yeah, In Transit is Broadway's first a cappella musical. So, and for people that are coming to the show, you have never heard anything like this before. We have some phenomenal people on our team. If you're a fan of Frozen, one of our writers is Kristen Anderson Lopez, who won the Oscar for the music in Frozen. And if you're a fan of Pitch Perfect, our vocal arranger is Deep Sharon, who worked on all the Pitch Perfect movies as well as the Sing-Off as well. And he's kind of like the godfather of modern-day a cappella nowadays. And so that's kind of the sound that we are bringing to Broadway, and it's kind of never really happened before. It's the story of 11 New Yorkers who the one thing that makes them all the thing that keeps them all in common is that they all have to travel on the subway, which is something, as most New Yorkers know, doesn't matter if you're, you know, a Wall Street executive or a public school teacher or a high school student or, you know, a line cook. The fastest way to get from point A to point B oftentimes is taking the subway.
Definitely.
And so these 11 New Yorkers, the whole thing takes place in the New York City subway system, but these 11 New Yorkers, which you find out are later connected, are all trying to get from point A to point B. And oftentimes, which happens in New York City public transport, you know, it's you get from point A to point, you try to get from point A to point B, but, you know, your train gets delayed. And, you know, or maybe, you know, now your train just got turned into a bus. Or there are service changes, or you have to transfer, or you're running late, and, you know, and or you don't get from point A to point B the way you think you're going to get there. You have to go from point A to point L to point B.
Right.
And the New York City subway system becomes an analogy for these 11 New Yorkers that are kind of trying to get somewhere and go through life in New York City. And the storyline that I'm involved in, you know, I play Steven, and I am one half of a gay couple. My fiance Trent comes from a very, you know, very conservative, religious Texas home. My character Steven comes from a very liberal East Coast upbringing. We are engaged to be married, and it is time for us now to go home to Texas and tell Trent's mama that Steven is not the roommate, as she thinks, but is actually the fiance, and that the wedding is coming up, and we're there to ask for her blessing. Well, we get to Texas. It doesn't quite happen that way, and that actually causes a big conflict in our relationship, and it kind of threatens our marriage as well. And you watch, you know, Trent and Steven kind of work through it during the course of the show. I get to play opposite the amazing Justin Guarini,
yes,
who many people will remember from his Broadway credits, but also from American Idol as well. He was a runner-up to Kelly Clarkson on the first season of American Idol, and he's a brilliant scene partner and singing partner, and it's been a joy to play his show husband.
Rumor has it that it could perhaps be said that some of this material is inspired from your life.
Well, it's very interesting. You know, the writers originally wrote the show in 2001, and this really the four writers were all 20-somethings, 30-somethings that were going through the struggles of New York City. You know, heartbreak and breakups and, you know, struggling actors had to find temp jobs, and, you know, gay couples who had trouble coming out. And what happened was 9/11 happened, and these four writers who were all part of an a cappella group decided to get together that night and console each other. And that evening they decided, we are going to write a love letter to New York. And instead of being an a cappella group that sings, you know, covers of Madonna songs or Indigo Girls songs or Michael Jackson songs, why don't we write songs about our lives in New York City as a way to celebrate the city? And so that's how it really started. But now it's 2017. So, you know, when they wrote the material for Steven and Trent, this was, you know, Don't Ask, Don't Tell was still
right.
A thing. There was no such thing as gay marriage being legal, you know, on the Supreme Court level. You know, there was we've made so much progress as a community since 2001. And so our writers, as we were going through previews, you know, and as we were going through, you know, we were dealing with the results, the shocking results of the Trump election, they said, we have the advantage of being a Broadway musical that takes place in 2017, post-election. I want to write to what the gay community is actually feeling right now. And, you know, my partner and I, you know, we've been together for 12 years. And, you know, after the election, we sat stunned watching the television, like most Americans. And the first thing that I said to him was, I think it's time. I think we have to go to City Hall and get married.
Wow.
And I think it's time that we, you know, we know that there is going to be a fight for our civil liberties and our rights. You know, there's going to be a fight for people of color, for immigrants, for our LGBT brothers and sisters. And I said, if we are going to fight alongside them, we want a stake in this fight. And I was like, if I'm going to have to fight for our rights to be married in this country, like, I want them to have to pry that ring off my finger. So I said, we have to do it. But we wanted to do it before the inauguration. So we looked at our calendars and we said, well, the first time that we have a day off between, you know, now and the inauguration is the day after opening. So Jimmy and I secretly went to City Hall and got married the day after the opening night of In Transit on Broadway. Our writers pulled me into a room and said, listen, we want to do some rewrites on this gay storyline, I told them of our secret plan. That we said, you know what, we're going to go to City Hall, we're going to get married, we're going to make everything legal, and then we'll throw a big party later. And our writers said, oh my gosh, can we put that in the show? That feels the most truthful to kind of what is happening to the gay community right now. I said, sure, put it in the show. So now, actually, 8 times a week, I get to live out that experience that Trent and Stephen go through. You know, I am Stephen in many ways. Like now, you know, and there is kind of a, I feel like there is a little bit of anxiety and fear, but also what that has also caused in our society today is also a real strengthening in our identity as a community, and a real need to be vocal. And I felt like that was our own way of doing that. Jimmy and I were always planning to get married at some point, but all of a sudden after that election, there was an urgency to have that done, and a deep need. And if anything, it's kind of solidified our love for each other and also our common desire to be very vocal about our relationship and to use that as not just, you know, we love each other, but also use it as a way of protesting kind of what's happening in the world right now.
Incredible. Incredible. All right, listeners, this is what we need you all to do right this very second. You can, of course, stroll on over to TellyLeung.com and learn more about Telly. You can go to iTunes and download both albums, actually all the cast albums he's ever been on, but in particular, you must download I'll Cover You and Songs for You. You can also catch him at the Circle in the Square Theater, starring in Transit. I can think of no better wedding registry than going to get tickets there to celebrate Telly. To celebrate Jimmy, he would love to have you there in the audience. It's great stuff.
Right.
You're doing incredible stuff, Telly.
Thank you, Ken. It's such a joy talking to you.
Please keep doing what you're doing.
And please send the Indigo Girls my love and tell them they have a big fan in me.
Galileo's head was on a block. His crime was looking up the truth. And as the bombshells of my daily fears explode, I try to trace them to my youth. And then you had to bring up reincarnation.
All right, folks, that is all the time we have left for this week's incredible show. My gosh, if you don't think that I am so appreciative for this opportunity to get to talk to heroes of mine and people who are just doing the most incredible work, wow, are you wrong? Because this is incredible. I just spoke to Emily Saliers, and she is just my goddess in my life. And Telly Leung is doing such incredible work. You must go check him out at Circle in the Square. Go see In Transit. Go visit Telly Leung at his website. That's TellyLeung.com, TellyLeung.com. And of course, EmilySaliers.com and IndigoGirls.com. And can't wait to see her on April 1st at the Akron Civic Center. You guys, thanks as always for listening. Thanks for your support. You can, of course, pick up my book. It is available for pre-order on Amazon right this very second. It's called Seriously, What Am I Doing Here? The Adventures of a Wondering and Wandering Gay Jew. Go pick it up. It's right on Amazon. Just search for my name, Ken Schneck, S-C-H-N-E-C-K. Get out there. Go do whatever it is that you do to use your voice to raise up the voices of your LGBTQ brothers and sisters, of all of our allies out there. And while you're out there using your voice, while you're out there making a difference, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?